Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may know the name James Shamus from, well, Focus Features, an incredible number of films, many of which he wrote. What were some of the films that you wrote for Focus Features?
Well, you know, I had a long career, still do actually, working with Ang Lee. Yes. So if you go back to The Ice Storm or The Wedding Banquet.
Wedding Banquet or Eat, Drink, Man, Woman.
Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, The Hulk.
Right with the Devil. Yeah. No, not just The Hulk. Not The Incredible Hulk, just The Hulk. Because apparently he didn't need an adjective as far as you were concerned.
No, we were so not incredible.
Well, he has made his debut as writer-director with the adaptation of the Philip Roth novel, Indignation. First of all, thanks so much for being here. And you know, as I was watching the film, we actually talked to you on a plane coming back in Sundance, and I thought that line from your book on Gertrude that really seems to apply to this, which is textual realism.
Wow. You went right for the abstract stuff. This is awesome. Textual realism. Yeah, look, you know, you're adapting a novel by, I think, one of the greatest living writers in English, Philip Roth. So you better be textual, because obviously these are gifts that you have to take seriously. On the other hand, it's also, as you know, a burden. You've got to make real something that exists in the voice, in the language of Philip Roth, and you don't have that benefit when you're shooting a movie. You're just setting up a camera and putting some actors in front of it and costumes and makeup, and that's a very different proposition. So yeah, we had to mix both a kind of reverence for and a well-earned reverence for Philip Roth on the one hand, and a sense that we had to do something, you know, a little different.
But it's one of these things, I guess, I think about and with all your work as a writer is, it's almost given that, you know, this book is set in Winesburg, and you think about Winesburg as being this place with all these vignettes that build to an emotional narrative rather than a plot. That's what this book is too, and you really, by sort of moving some of the Korean War stuff out of it, you really make it about that kind of emotional narrative, don't you?
Yeah, to me, that was the real lure of the novel at the end of the day. I mean, Philip Roth, as a writer, you can't beat. But as somebody you want to adapt to make a movie out of his work, well, that's a different proposition. That's tougher, precisely because the writing is so phenomenal. You can often lose track of what you need to actually replace that writing with, right? So in the novel, Roth is drawing on his own experiences from his own youth when he actually went to Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. But it's a very similar situation to the situation that his hero faces at this made-up college called Winesburg College in Ohio. We know Winesburg from the great book, A Kind of Interconnected Short Stories by Sherwood Anderson. You know, tremendously depressing book. But those are the kind I like. And so we're at
Winesburg. We would never know it from the books that you turned into movies. We'd never know that at all.
Exactly. So Winesburg really is both Roth's tip of the hat to a precursor that a lot of Americans now have forgotten. I don't think Anderson is really that well read or as revered as he once was. But on the other hand, it's a collision. It's a culture clash where this young Jewish kid shows up in the middle of white Christian 1951 paranoid McCarthy America. And let's say hilarity does not necessarily ensue, although there are some laughs in the movie.
No, it does, yeah.
We got some laughs.
I mean, there's a great scene with your hero and the dean of the college, which comes a lot from the book, but you put your own spin on it as well.
You know, this scene, which has become much talked about, because it's a little weird to make a movie in the middle of the movie, you just have two people sit and talk about, like, God.
For 10 minutes.
Yeah, even more, but I'm glad you thought it was 10. It's actually longer. And it was pretty fun. You were at Sundance, so the experience of watching the scene unfold, and I knew it was going to be weird. Didn't know how weird. Well, I kind of knew. I did. And at the end of which, you know, the audience burst into applause, which I was really, as you can imagine, appreciative of, because you're asking people to stop, in a sense. and watch two characters go at it, but verbally. But at the same time, there's a physicality to the scene. And it is a clash of cultures. The dean of the college, who's played by Tracy Letts, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, but he's also a Tony Award-winning actor, and he's a god, and he's 6'4", and he's very intimidating, and he's from Oklahoma, and he's, you know, just the best. And you've got young Logan Lerman, who plays our Jewish young Jewish hero, who's been acting since he was 8, but has never had the opportunity to work in the theater. So I think there was a sense of, you know, can this guy kind of go mano a mano with one of the greats of American theater? How's that going to work out? And to see them go at it and to see them take essentially Roth's language. In fact, most of that scene is a transcription from the book, although that was the hardest scene for me to write, oddly, because sometimes when you're adapting a novel and you are given the gift of this great dialogue, you still have to shape and trim and, you know, write interstitially. And I sweated over every line of that scene. So in the weirdest way, it was both the easiest scene to write because I was more or less typing out Philip Roth's own words, and the most difficult because I thought, wow, we are going to have 15 minutes in the middle of this movie, and this audience has to understand, even if it's subconscious, that there is some kind of underlying structure to the scene. And I knew that structure had to be emotional, had to be visual, had to be narrative, all those things. So that was a toughie, yeah.
So many of those scenes, those dialogue scenes in the book, and you find this in the movie as well, you chose to do this, are about these shifts in power, these power dynamics that our hero thinks he comes in with power sometimes and does not. I mean, the scenes with his father or with sort of kind of girlfriend. And I guess I find myself thinking about what you do so often, which is these coming-of-age stories in which people are certainly aware of their physical power as adults. And sometimes it's sexual and sometimes it's violent, but it's always about that kind of physicality. And that really interests you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting because I didn't know it interested me until you just said that. So I have to think about it now, which is really tough. You know, I'm supposed to be on autopilot here.
I didn't mean to wake you up, but you want to go back to the script. So what was it like making a movie, James?
Thank you so much. You know, that's so funny. Look, this question of the body and embodiment and the surprise of it, and quite frankly, whether it's power or, in a sense, an experience of power that's also experienced as its inverse, which is desire. You know, when you're the most abject, when you're the most desiring, can you have it? Do you have it? Once you have it, is it gone, right? The expensive spirit is a waste of shame, as Shakespeare would put it. And I think our young hero is in a sense, ambushed and surprised by the power of his desire and its embodiment, something he just thought he was in control of himself. And that at a certain moment in a borrowed car at night in a graveyard after his first date and only one, essentially, with the blonde goddess, Olivia Hutton, played by Sarah Gadon, his whole world is turned over. I mean, it's just he is completely unmoored gravitationally from who he thought he was. And it is odd, of course, in the year 2016, to think of a narrative, an entire film devoted to the obliteration in essence of a young man by one, the gift of one sexual act. Nowadays you think, well, that's pretty, you know, you talk to college kids these days. There's a cultural difference. Things have changed. On the other hand, they haven't at all. That's the crazy thing. They haven't changed that much. I think young people, old people, all of us are constantly kind of astonished and confounded by the appearance in us of these desires. And I do think Roth is one of the greats at managing to bring to light in a deeply honest and often disturbing way exactly the contours of the crisis that comes when you find out you're embodied in that way.
It's the treatment we're talking about, things, I guess, that my friend, writer-director James Shames didn't know about his own films. His debut as director is the adaptation of Philip Roth's Indignation. As we were talking about this thing, though, I find myself thinking about how that moment of revelation becomes almost a ruinous moment for so many of your protagonists.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we often kid ourselves that the quest for meaning in our lives is the equivalent of the quest for truth. But it turns out that truth is often not our best friends, at least when it's delivered to us in the ways that it most often is, by other actors, other characters, or by ourselves at moments of revelation that may not be the most convenient time to actually learn those truths. So truth is really tough. It's not the friendliest, nicest thing.
But you are so interested in protagonists, as you talk about this, who think of themselves as being clear-headed until they come at this moment of reckoning and find out that they are not.
Yeah, yeah. And probably the essence of it is, and I think why we've been lucky so far in our festival screenings, and I hope with the ye olde general public, with that scene between Dean Codwell and Logan Lerman. Because the crazy thing about that scene is that you could look at it as if Tracy Letts is playing this conservative, authoritarian, patriarchal, rude, guy who's just kind of just putting his thumb down on poor young Logan Lerman, right?
I mean, they actually are, when they sit down, two archetypes.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the craziest thing about that scene. And I had this discussion with the actors as we were preparing it. I said, I don't know if you noticed, but every single thing that Dean Codwell says to our hero, which eventually, in a sense, helps destroy him, is true. Whereas our hero is actually not totally truthful in that scene. Very interesting.
But I think that happens. I even think that is kind of the case with Riot with the Devil, where there's this idea of somebody thinking he knows what the absolute truth is and being confronted with the fact that it is not the truth.
Yeah, Riot with the Devil was such a strange experience. We made a movie, Ang Lee and I made a movie based on Daniel Woodrow's novel.
Yeah, it was the first of his books to be adapted to screen, was it not?
Yeah, and then of course he went on to have Winter's Bone adapted. And that was the beginning of a career of, what's her name? Oh, Jennifer Lawrence. One of the great, I mean, I think that's still one of her greatest roles.
And her first Oscar nomination. But, yeah. But his books tend to be more about a kind of a sort of, there's a kind of dirtiness in those characters.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a dirty fingernail thing going on and all that stuff. But the crazy thing about Ride of the Devil, just starting with, oh, you think you know, but you don't, is precisely a challenge to the kind of liberal and even conservative consensus here in the United States, which really has crafted and recrafted a mythology around our own history, in particular around the Civil War. So here you are in Missouri, right, where Mark Twain comes from, dead center of the country. Geographically, it's the center. And here you are, you know, the Civil War is coming along, and you've got a state like Missouri, which is a union state, but which is pro-slavery. It's a slave-holding state that is for the union. So you start with that very simple fact, which is a fact, and you go to all your liberal friends who are like, yay, North, we won and freed the slaves. And you're like, well, yeah, but like then why would these guys in Missouri be fighting at what? And, you know, like, guys, seriously, it's really a lot more messed up than you think it is. And, you know, goodness did not prevail. The truth is weirder than you think. And the characters in that film are living that truth. And it's messy and it's dirty fingernail and it's violent and it's horrific at times, but it's also cleansing in some ways to be, you know, slapped in the face a bit and told, you know what, you got to revise.
And again, this idea for a young person sort of coming to perception of adulthood, whether it be actual adulthood or not, the idea of physical control in this case in that movie being violence rather than strictly speaking sex, but it's still a kind of explosion of sorts, isn't it?
Yeah. And lest we forget, even in a, you know, rather polite period drama as Indignation may well present itself to be, there's weirdly a lot of violence in the movie. It's kind of weird, but it's there. It's right there in front of you and it's hard to notice sometimes because the package looks so kind of, you know, Merchant Ivory-ish. But weirdly, there's obviously psychic violence, which is, you know, that's civilization. But we've got some punching, we got some killing, we got it all. We got shooting, punching, killing, we got the whole thing. We got imminent death everywhere.
I can't wait to see the trailer. It's The Treatment. We'll take a break. My guest is James Shames. His first movie as director, but he's written many films. It's the adaptation of Philip Roth's Indignation. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Well, Welcome back. We're talking about killing and punching and imminent death with my guest, James Shamus. His first film as director is the adaptation of Indignation. So you were talking about your films with Aang, and the one thing I guess I thought is that when you don't have a sounding board, that other person, and it's really a partnership that you guys have, when that's absent, what is it like being on the set?
Well, for me, I mean, there's two things. Aang and I certainly do have a partnership, but like most long-running partnerships, we have grown over the decades increasingly deaf. So, you know, we're more than happy to hang out with each other, but I don't think he's listened to me or I've listened to him really for at least the last,
I hope all you aspiring filmmaker partnerships are listening to this. Yes. Don't pay attention to your partner and things will be fine.
Well, no, you just have dinner and a cup of coffee and somebody pays the check and then you go home and go to sleep. It's pretty much like a successful marriage. So, but for me, you know, the stepping into the director's seat, especially at my own advanced age, I knew there were things I didn't know. No one had ever asked me where to put the camera before. No one had ever asked me to work with actors before. Those were the two huge challenges, and they were really fun to meet. They were daunting, but I tackled them. You know, that's what you do. You get up and prep. The one thing that I was less prepared for, having been on so many sets over the years and thinking I knew my way around a film set, was the lived experience of folding yourself in every single working day on the set into an environment that you had to be 100% present for all the time. It was a blast, but it was the day was different because you never can step away. You don't take phone calls. You don't really return emails. You don't do anything but be with the people you're with and do the thing you do.
And then when the day finishes, you're thinking about all those things for the very next day.
Absolutely. You're just prepping and either the car ride home or the subway ride home in our case, often here in New York where we shot the film. And then the trip to the set the next morning, you're just devoted to solving that day's problems with the people who are with you. And it was a gift, right? I think that it's very much a craft. And there is probably a guy right now up in, you know, Vermont making a chair who's having a very similar experience, although my experience was with hundreds of other people. We're all solving it together. But there is that sense of purpose and focus that only when you are, I think, in that craft seat, the director or some other craft place, that you really experience. And certainly you don't experience it as a producer.
But you're talking about application of craft. If you're making a chair at a certain point, you know how to use your materials. As a filmmaker, especially as a director, you're talking about application of craft to a situation that not only changes from film to film, but day to day, because there are all these variables you couldn't possibly predict.
Yeah. It's not mass production. It is serial production. So you are – everything is always a new issue or a new problem, right? And part of that is just allowing the problem to present itself as or in the form of a potential solution too. You're, you know, working with actors, right? They will never and nor should they ever be asked to conform to some predisposed notion that you have as to the line reading or the actual bearing or any of that stuff. You've got to let them fly. On the other hand, you can't just let everybody
I'm sorry,
make their own movie.
You wrote a book on Carl Dreyer. You're somehow saying you can't impose your will on the movie? This is what you called two opposing ideas that you're holding.
Yeah. Look, there are directors among my favorites, Carl Theodor Dreyer, the great Danish director of, you know, The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Called Gertrude, but anyway, that's
yeah, Gertrude. I wrote a book on his most obscure movie by one of the most obscure directors out there. But Elvis Mitchell knows this book, so
it's the one book I read. So I keep planning to read another, but that took so much time.
But also, folks like John Ford and Alfred Hitchcock, these are control freaks for sure.
There's all imposition of will to them, and actors who are mostly terrified of them.
Yeah, yeah. At the same time. You know, and again, you see it with Ford, for example, but you also see it with Dreyer. You know, Ford was a guy who got to set, and yeah, he was pretty much of a world-class jerk to most of his actors, in particular John Wayne, who it was amazing. They had such a strange relationship. On the other hand, you will notice that in almost every account of his films, he didn't rehearse much, and in fact, he didn't give much direction to his actors. He watched them. He talked to them. He would give them a few words.
He told them when they were wrong, though. He was very specific about that.
He was specific about it. But you notice that it's not a la David Fincher with 40, 50, 60, 70 takes. John Ford did one, two, or three takes. And if you read his interviews and talk to the people who worked with him, he always said he always wanted the first take. That was the one that was fresh, where the actors were still exploring, where they weren't quite prepared. They didn't quite hit their marks. They didn't quite get exactly what he was going for, but he wanted to preserve the reality of what they brought.
But it's funny because you're talking about serial production. That really was what that was.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you talk about lived in too. And one thing I thought that really struck me about this, and I mentioned this to you when I saw you, is the fact that those rooms all look like people lived in. Yeah. I mean, and that's something that I find really hard to do in period film, because so much you find yourself, wow, I sure would love to own that lamp, or where did he find those shoes? And in fact, that's not the way the movie feels at all.
No, and I'm very, look, A, I'm a research nerd. You know, that's my other life. I'm a professor at Columbia. But also I've always, when I've done period films, had to maintain a very strict regimen with the creative team, either as producer or now as a director, and get to work with people who know their stuff. So Inbal Weinberg, for example, was our designer on this movie. And she and I had the exact same philosophy, which is it's 1951. Therefore, do not go to the furniture catalog or, in terms of our wardrobe, to the magazines and say, oh, look, this is what everybody was wearing in 1951. No, in 1951, people were living in houses that they might have lived in since 1937. And maybe they had bought a new couch in 1948, right? So this thing we have on period films where everything is like a date stamp of the year of the film is insane. That doesn't work. It doesn't happen. So we really worked hard to make sure that the people that we were living with had been living, not just walking onto a set a la 1951.
I really found that in the scenes with his father, that really felt to me like that was a world that hadn't changed at all. And since he opened that shop, that place, it was a time capsule of the moment that he was in there, and maybe the calendar changed, but nothing else, and the meat, but nothing else did.
Yeah,
so let's hope the meat.
Let's hope the meat changed.
It's a treat. We're talking about design with my guest writer-director, James Shamans. His first film as director is Indignation. But that's, I just find that idea of trying to build what feels like this place that exists and is not just something that's there for the camera must have been something you gave a lot of deliberation to in a way that probably surprised you.
Yeah, it did, because I had to think about it differently than the way I think when I think as a scholar, you know, as a professor or as a producer, even when I have to just, I'm putting the building blocks together. This time you had to think about it in terms of a relationship with the actors, right? Everything is about what's going to trigger the good stuff for them, what's going to make them fly, what's going to make them commit and feel confident and comfortable and safe, knowing that they can take risks in front of the camera and that we're there to catch them. So that, you know, it was an ongoing conversation. And as you know, actors are, you know, they're the most vulnerable people on the set. And so on the one hand, you want to be respectful of that. On the other hand, you can't treat people with kid gloves, especially great actors, because they'll smell a little fear in you. Right? They'll say, oh, well, what is he? Why is he being so? What's going on? And maintaining the proper balance, basically, of the highest of expectations and the most rigorous of approaches, with at the same time, total empathy for what actors go through, was a new experience for me.
But so many of these things that you worked on as a writer, and it certainly applies to Indignation as well, are these sort of looks back by these authors who basically are really unsentimental about the past that they're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Here's the deal. It turns out that a fog of sentimentality puts a kind of gauze of falseness on the emotions that you're looking back at, and then you lose the empathy. You're actually colder. You're actually more abstract. You're actually less convincing and emotionally resonant than the unsentimental ones. The fact is, and I think Roth is a perfect example of this, you may think that he's unsentimental. You may think that the characters or personae or narrators or author figures or whatever you're calling these beings that exist in his work are kind of putzy and rude and not nice.
They are putzy and rude,
yes,
not
exactly.
Nice.
But here's the thing. It's the mere fact that somebody of his intelligence is looking back so scrupulously and honestly at these characters, and the characters including his own personae, himself in a sense, that act itself is an act of incredible empathy, right? And so the power of his, you know, I have a colleague at Columbia who's written on Roth. He's an American literature scholar named Ross Posnick, who's written a book called Roth's Rude Truth. And I think that the rudeness is a way of getting to a truth that is only accessible through precisely that kind of unsentimentality. But, at the end of the day, you earn the sentiment.
Yeah, but as he says in his book, there's a difference between being unsentimental and being emotionless. And this is not what we're talking about. But right. That need to cut through all of that is almost – and there's an underlying anger in all these pieces that you've turned to as an adapter. And I just wonder, that's one of the things that first and foremost you feel like you want to deal with.
Yeah, because as you can tell, I'm just generally an angry, bitter guy.
Please stop sweating at me. Please stop it. It's awful in here.
So
it's like being in a room with Stanley Kowalski. Just quit.
I know. It's very funny because I, in my own life, I'm just not – the angry guy.
But every single one of these books, not all of them, but certainly many of them, the Ice Storm or Lost Caution, these are really angry characters who are telling themselves that they're not. They're telling themselves that they're being truthful, but there's anger in that.
Yeah, yeah. And I've got to own up, obviously. There's somewhere within me, the ulcer is forming.
But no, I'm wondering, is it because these characters exist in a kind of state of constant exegesis for you, or what is this?
No, I think they probably allow me to express my own anger, I would say. Let's face facts. Even the title Indignation is a title that announces a certain anger at the way in which our country, our society, our patriarchy just churns up, the best and brightest of its generations. And this seems to be an ongoing pattern with us. And so it's worth raising a hand and pointing that out in a way that people can engage with.
But these characters, and again, these books are so much about that. And I don't think I've ever talked to you about a book you've adapted until this very conversation. So these are things that have been kind of piling up in my head for a very long time. But that kind of this anger is almost this thing that finally the one thing that these people can control, rather the one thing that they all own. They're almost proprietary about this anger.
That's right. And I think at the same time, the word indignation is interesting because it's not anger, right? In English, it's very difficult for us to understand the roots of the word and how they inform. In American English, we just think of indignation. Oh, you're indignant. You're angry. But in fact, indignation means, in a sense, a combination of all kinds of weird stuff. Like, I am indignant because I'm not dignified. My dignity has been taken away. And yet, my expression of indignity makes me dignified again. So that you're both dignified and indignant or indignified at the same time. And, in current contemporary context that were happening just when Philip Roth was publishing this novel, for example, 2008, and on when you had the Occupy Wall Street movement here, for example. Well, in Europe, places like Spain, that movement was not called Occupy. It was the people who were protesting and who have had profound impact on political structures in places like Spain were called Indignados, often inspired by a pamphlet that was published by a then, I think he was 93-year-old jurist in France named Stefan Hessel. And the pamphlet was called Indignez-vous, which again is a phrase that you can't really translate. It means indignify yourself, right? Make yourself indignant.
Really absorbing that quality.
Yeah.
But these characters, do you feel that they in some way, their growth is almost kind of basically cut off because this thing happens to them that they never really get past.
Yeah. Therein lies the tragic form and of a lot of these films that I've worked on, right? Where these characters are offered up as sacrifices for us. And you could read that form as an inherently conservative one, which is basically a warning like, don't get too indignant. Here's what's going to happen. On the other hand, I think the politics of that kind of presentation of this tragic form of indignity, the voice that is raised to a pitch that nobody listens, the young life that says, wait, I don't want to be part of this. And the system says, great, you won't be part of it. You're dead. These are reminders to us. I think there's things we can do with these images and these stories.
We're out of time. I can't thank you enough, James. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Really a pleasure.
You say that now. He's probably indignant, which is the name of the movie. It's his adaptation of a Philip Roth novel. Our recording engineer here at Argo Studios in New York is Paul Ruess. The show is mixed by Kat Ure. It's edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I'm also not indignant. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.